attaboy. Yeah, that's right. We're going to ride farther and faster than the normal ride. Oh, yeah, boy. You're ready. Saddle's on and cinched up tight. Stick that head over here and let me get that bit in your mouth. Now the bridle's on. We have a special ride today, Lightning. It's a super studcast day. Time to give our fans the very best. And we're going to climb a couple of wrestling mountains and ride into history.
Yeehaw!
Super Studcast cover wrestlers of all kinds and from everywhere. Super Studcast number 24 crosses the Atlantic Ocean to a beautiful spot in Wales to bring patrons a very different type of wrestler. People around the world are not sure what he is, and he doesn't mind. This is our first journey to the European continent to visit one of the strangest wrestlers in history. A dangerous shooter, singer, songwriter, book writer, actor, artist, and so much more. Part 1, now available, is absolutely fascinating as you meet one of the greatest wrestling stars in the world who conquered Europe and its champions long before arriving in America. This could only be one person on earth, the exotic one himself, Adrian Street. There has never been a Super Studcast like this one, and fan or not, you will not want to miss this piece of wrestling history.
A grizzly till its bones begin to crack. I eat a dozen T-bones for my early morning snack. So imagine what I could do to you. I could tear a telephone directory in two. Bending iron bars is something else that I can do. I always pick my teeth with the nearest billiard cue. So imagine what I could do to you. To see my many attributes won't need a second glance. You know if you resisted, you just wouldn't stand a chance. I can knock a hole right through a solid concrete wall. I can pull a tree out by its roots and that's not all. Now you know about me, you don't need a crystal ball to tell you just what I could do to you.
Welcome, everybody, and patrons of the Super Studcast. This being Super Studcast number 24, we are going to be talking with a man whose groundbreaking career covered 62 years. But to tell you more about our guest is the man himself, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, the legend. Ron, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great this morning. Good to have you on here with me again. And this one is going to be fun. I can guarantee you that. I'm really going to enjoy it. I just want to say a few things about this gentleman before we get him on the phone here and we get him ready to go. Well, I'm going to tell this story right off the bat. He sends me a tape in 1985, and I'm in the studio in Dothan, Alabama, where we were still recording Southeastern at that time. And I have the tape. I hadn't had a chance to see it. I take it to the television station, and there's the normal guys in the control room. You got the director there. You got the cameraman hanging out there. You got several people in the control room. And I say, hey, could you put this tape on for me and let me watch it for a couple of minutes? This is a guy I really don't know. I'm not familiar with. I want to see him. And they throw it on the 2-inch machine. Then that thing starts to roll and my gosh, it wasn't 20 seconds until instead of just me watching, there was like eight of them. And they're all going, who is that? What is he doing? And I'm like, wait a minute, guys, just be quiet here a minute. Right. And Adrian is doing an intro and he's coming to the ring and he's singing his song, which is a great song, by the way. Just think what I could do to you, I think is the name of the song. And he's all dressed up. He's got on all of his garb. His face is painted. And they are all like, wow, what is this? I've never seen anything like that. And then I'm wanting to see him wrestle. You know, I'm like, wow. I mean, this is heavy duty stuff. I've never seen anybody do this. And then the match starts. They ring the bell and he starts wrestling. And all of a sudden, you know, my first impression was that he's Europe's Gorgeous George, right? I mean, you know, he looks kind of like Gorgeous George, but he's gone a lot further than Gorgeous George. But then when I saw him wrestle and make a few wrestling moves, I was like, wow. I mean, this guy has not only a fantastic gimmick, but he has tremendous wrestling ability. And, you know, it was a no-brainer for me at that point. I turn around, the guys are standing there, and I say, what do you think, guys? Would he work out here in Dothan, Alabama, and in the Deep South? And they go, God, I don't know, Ron. Man, I've never seen anything like it. So I just, I made the decision right away. I said, my goodness, you know, I've got to get in touch with him. I really want this guy. So I'm about to introduce a guy that, you know, is he's a tremendous talent, and not a just one way. He's multi-talented. He can do everything. He's done everything, basically. He's one of the most colorful characters in the history of the sport, in my opinion, and a tremendous person. Once you get to know Adrian and his lovely wife, Miss Linda, they are phenomenal people. And it's just a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to have him on the 24th Super Studcast. And he's in Wales. We're going to be crossing the Atlantic with this conversation. He's on another continent. And it's just my distinct pleasure. I want to get him on here, and I'd like to bring him in right now if we can do that. Adrian, are you there?
I certainly am.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on here, Adrian. I've been wanting to do this for a long, long time. I mean, you're a story among stories in wrestling, and we're going to have some fun here today. It's been a long time since you and I have seen each other. Well, not that long, but a little bit of time. And I told the story about seeing you on tape and then deciding to have you come in. And you come to Pensacola, and it's kind of like it becomes a home for you. I mean, you really got with the community, and you just were accepted by everybody, and you became one of the one of family. You became the part of that family that we had with Continental and with Southeastern Wrestling, and it's just a real pleasure to have you come in about 1985 with us.
Well, I tell you what, I really enjoyed it. It was my favorite territory. I mean, Linda and I wrestled all over the states from California, where we started. We wrestled in the Northeast as well, Ohio. We spent some time there. Kansas, you name it, we've been there. But my favorite memories, well, I mean, it speaks for itself. That is where Linda and I settled down. We bought six properties altogether in Gulf Breeze. So that just shows that, you know, I'm not just talking through my backside. That was a place that we really, really, really loved. But it's only that, well, for one thing, the hurricanes and things like that kept on sort of messing up our garden. We had a 4-acre garden full of beautiful fruit trees and tropical plants. It's absolutely gorgeous, but we had our place messed up a number of times by hurricanes. And I said to Linda, well, it's not a matter of, you know, it's going to happen again. And it seemed to be getting more severe. It wouldn't have mattered like if, it was like when it was going to happen. And then when President Trump sort of got to be the head honcho there, I said to Linda, I think we're going to leave before they replaced Donald Trump with Donald Duck. But another big reason was I've got grandchildren I'd never seen. And like all my family live in various parts of Britain. Well, most of them anyway. I mean, I've got family in Australia, but you know, I've got grandkids I'd never seen, ranging from, I've got a middle-aged grandson, and I've got another one that's, what is, 2-3 years of age?
Three,
yeah, he just had his third birthday. And, oh, I love them to death. They're beautiful.
Oh, man. So, you know, let's just start, since you're back there talking about going home and seeing your grandkids for the first time. You know, I just want to kind of take the journey with fans here of your life, you know, when were you born and where were you born exactly?
I was born in a place called Bryn Mawr, and Bryn Mawr in Welsh means big hill, and I lived on the highest part of it. But the thing is, I was there, obviously I was there, I was born in 1940. So I remember the war. In actual fact, I've still got a gas mask. I've still got like a little rubber gas mask and everything like that that I was issued when I was about 3 years of age. I've still got that sucker. And we were supposed to put those on when Hitler started dropping the gas bombs. At this particular time, my father was a prisoner of war with the Japanese. I never actually met my father. I was like about 6 months old, I think, when he went into the army. He was taken prisoner in Java after he'd sort of fought against the Japs in Singapore, Malaya, Sumatra. They fought the Japs all the way along. They were sort of chased all the way down the Sumatran Peninsula. They managed to escape over to Java just in time to find out that the Dutch had surrendered to the Japanese, so they actually landed there as prisoners. He was a prisoner for 3.5 years with the Japanese. Anyway, when he finally got home, I was really looking forward to seeing my father and everything like that. I'd never sort of met him. The first time I met him was like about 2 weeks, I think, before my fifth birthday. And for whatever reason, he didn't like me. And I soon learned to dislike him very much, too. He threatened me with the coal mine all his life. I wanted to be a Red Indian in those days. And then later on, from the time I was about 11, I decided I wanted to be a professional wrestler. And that's when I first started lifting weights.
So your childhood, basically, then... I guess is you know, wasn't really a good childhood. I mean, obviously you're living in coal mining country, and you know, we're familiar with that in America. A lot of parts of America are coal mining, and that's a very tough life there. And obviously, did you work in the mines?
Well, my father was one of the toughest people I've met, but he had me out of school working in a coal mine when I was just 15 years of age. So I ran away from home when I was 16, almost starved to death in London. Even found myself sleeping on park benches and things like that. I started boxing on a fairground booth. I was boxing anywhere between 4 and 7 times in one day on a fairground booth, and I can't box. I can wrestle. I can fight like hell. I tell you what, if there's anything I can do better than wrestling, it's fighting. But that boxing, they've got rules and things like that. I don't like rules, as you know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've always said it doesn't matter how you win as long as you cheat.
Well, you know, boxing now, so you're boxing at 16 years old, trying to make a living. I guess you're getting paid, right? You're working on a fair, basically, right? Yeah, kind of a fair situation where fans, people in the crowd fight you, or do they have other fighters that fight you?
First of all, I start fighting against the boxers that they already had, like on the fairground booth. But I became very popular in spite of the fact that I couldn't box. I became very, very popular, and they gave me a job on there. So I was taking on all comers. The last fight that I had was against a big gypsy, and I tell you what, I don't know if you're familiar with gypsies and things like that. Damn, they could fight. And this guy caved all my ribs in, and I ended up with the last bit of strength I had, picking him up and body slamming him on his head. I got disqualified for that, but I still got paid.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good.
But anyway, the boxing booth left, the fairground and the booth that was part of it. They actually left London, and they wanted me to go with them, and I was going to. But then the thing is, London was the place I was going to become a professional wrestler. That is what I made my mind up. And like Napoleon Bonaparte said, when you set out to take Vienna, take Vienna. So I kissed the fairground goodbye and concentrated on wrestling. And I had my first contest while I was still 16 years of age.
Who trained you?
I thought I was a great wrestler, but then I found out when I started getting on the mat with some of the really good amateurs in the YMCA, I wasn't anywhere near as good as I thought I was. I mean, they turned me inside out, upside down. I was a cocky little son. And I mean, they really enjoyed hurting me, you know. There was a Scottish wrestler called, I think he was Scottish. His name was Chick Osmond. And he took me to one side, like a room that had some mats. It was like away from like the public eyes and everything like that. And he really opened my eyes. Not only that, he said to me, "Listen, kid, would you do me a favor? Because I wanted to be Kid Tarzan Jonathan after my idol, who was Don Leo Jonathan." Then one day he said to me, "Kid," he said, "would you do me a favor?" He said, "I've got a chance to wrestle for the big time myself." And he said, "They won't let me take bookings from independents or anything like that." He said, "There's an independent, his name is Johnny Charles. He's running some shows that I'm supposed to be wrestling on, and I just can't do them, like if I'm going to be wrestling for the joint promotions at the big time." But I didn't even know there was any independence or anything like that. Anyway, I went along, introduced myself to these people, and they took me on. And the very first contest I had was main event against a guy called Gentleman Geoff Moran, yeah. When I wrestled with him, I still didn't really know what the business was about and everything like that. We went in the ring. He started rolling about and everything like that. He was a villain. He was their big villain in their main event. Anyway, when we came to grips, I took a wrist lock on him, dived up in the air, buried his head into the canvas, and dislocated his shoulder.
Great start.
So, I mean, I was kind of bewildered and everything like that, but I went to him. Oh, I mean, the crowd went mad because they'd never seen this guy getting beaten. Anyway, I walked back to the dressing room, burst into the dressing room and said to the promoter, "When am I going to get my first championship match? You know, that guy was your main event and, like, took me less than 2 minutes. You silly bastard." You know what I mean? He said, "People are not going to pay good money to see like a main event on his last 2 minutes." And he promised me £2.10 for the fight, main event. He cut my wages to £2. Then all of a sudden he came around. He said, "Kid, you're going to have to help me out." He said, "I've just heard from Jeff's wife. She's called me from the hospital. You've dislocated his shoulder. He ain't going to be wrestling for a while. You're going to have to take his place." And that's how I got my start.
Oh, Bobby, darn, man. So you hurt your way into, you hurt somebody to get your first start. And that's a great story in itself, man. How did you get, why wrestling? Why did you decide you wanted to be a wrestler?
Well, I've always had that sort of romantic sort of wanted to be a warrior sort of type of thing and everything. Like I said, I wanted to be a Red Indian, first of all. But, I mean, if I could have gone back time and been a gladiator, that is what I would have been. And I really like the idea. You know, I like to fight. I was fighting all the time when I was a kid. I really enjoyed fighting. The idea of actually dressing up like a gladiator and sort of fighting appealed to me even more, you know, like in front of an audience and everything like that, and getting cheered. I mean, I wouldn't have needed to have been a slave if I'd been back in the old sort of ancient Roman times. I would have done it just to make a living sort of way back then. Thank goodness I didn't do it.
Yeah, no kidding. Thank goodness you didn't come along in that time frame. Yeah. That would have been pretty nasty. So, you know, once you arrived in Pensacola in 85 or so, I mean, obviously Miss Linda's with you. If she's available, you know, I want an opportunity. I don't get to talk to many women in my wrestling programs here. So I wanted to get an opportunity, if she's there, to ask her a couple of questions about what it was like. How did you two meet? I want to ask Linda, how did you two meet?
I used to work in an aquarium shop in Croydon in London. And Adrian used to come in and buy fish from me, from the shop. And we sort of get talking and stuff, and he looked like he was interested in style and everything. And he kept asking me, oh, why don't you come and watch me wrestling? I'm wrestling in the Fairfield Halls. Is it tomorrow night? Why don't you come along, you know? And I was saying, oh, I don't know. I was sort of like a bit shy and stuff. But anyway, I didn't go the first time, and then I didn't see him for a while. Then the next time he came into the shop, he'd asked me again. Anyway, I thought to myself, damn it, I'll go. And the next time he asked me, so that's what I did. He was wrestling in the Fairfield Hall in Croydon, and I went and sat in the balcony at the front, and the ring was just below the balcony and everything. And when he came out, he sort of saw me there, and it was really nice because he came back afterwards and said, "Oh, what? Come have a drink with me." He says that in the green room. Anyway, took me home that night, and it's funny, really, because we haven't been apart since. You know.
Oh, geez, that's a sweet little story. When did you actually start doing the getting involved? At what point was that?
Well, that was when we went to Canada in 1981. We went to work for Stu Hart, and they wanted to call me Angel Dust to begin with, and I think they did that. I did go under that name for a short time. Then eventually, I didn't really like that, and I thought, well, Miss Linda would be much better.
Yeah, so yeah, you know, that's kind of a funky name in a way. You know what Angel Dust is? I mean, that's kind of, you know, I can't imagine who would want you to be called Angel Dust.
You know what the Harts are like. You know?
Oh, yeah, Stu Hart, I know him well.
I think you want to be a kind of angel dust.
You know, yeah. I can hear him talking to you.
And you know, he never wanted to pay me, right, in the beginning. I was supposed to work for free, you know, and we didn't like that too much. Anyway, I managed to get some wages from him, but then one night, we wrestled in Calgary in the main arena on a Saturday, and anyway, this big cowboy type jumped in the ring and tried attacking Adrian.
He was a footballer.
And anyway, we got him down in the corner, and I was stamping on him with my high heels. And from that day, he gave me a rise in wages.
Stu started paying you and taking care of you after that. Yeah, well, you probably appreciated the fact you're taking care of the business. You know, yeah. I was going to ask you, one of the questions I was going to ask you, Adrian, was about riots. You know, because I kind of like, in all of my Super Studcasts, I ask guys about, you know, Were you in lots of riots, or do you have any riots that really stick out in your mind? There, you were already talking about one, basically, right? This is the shoot she's talking about with the football player that jumps into the ring?
Yeah, he was a professional footballer. He came in came in the ring and tried to tackle me. I got him in the front chancery, run him across the ring so hard. We both burst through the ropes, and we landed on the timekeeper's table. I was on top of him. I had my thumb in his eye and my fingers on my other hand up his nose. I'd already sort of hooked his arm with my legs. He wouldn't go in anyway. But the next thing is, somebody was pushing me out of the way, and I was gonna sort of belt them as well. But it turned out to be Linda. She got up on the timekeeper's table. She had these big stiletto heels on a big leather boot, and she kept stomping him in the head, stomping him in the face. All of a sudden, Stu sort of turned up there. And I thought he was going to get angry, you know, I mean, the fact we were doing this. But, I mean, if anybody attacks me, I mean, I really have a go at him, you know. But, I mean, the guy was almost, Stu was almost having an orgasm. He wouldn't sort of, he never got over it. I mean.
He loved you forever.
The times I heard the story and everything like that of, I remember Linda getting up on the table and stomping that footballer and everything like that. You know, the funny thing is, that same footballer went up to the dungeon and actually became a professional wrestler.
Oh, I'll be darned, after that.
Yeah, but it was after we left. It's after we left the territory.
So I was going to ask you about the dungeon. So did you ever go out down into Stu's dungeon?
First time I went down there, it was let me show you the down in the dungeon here. Anyway, that was on, you know, that was on a Thursday, and we were supposed to be wrestling up in Edmonton on the Monday. But he says, have you seen this submission? He said, because you know, I used to wrestle with George Gordienko, and I used to wrestle with Luther Lindsay and everything, you know. I mean, yeah, you might have wrestled him, but I bet you never ever did anything to him, because Stu was a bloody phony when he came to put himself over as like a shoot wrestler and everything like that. He knew some shoot holds, but the thing is the difference between knowing holds and actually being able to apply them. The art of wrestling is you know yourself wrong, because I've wrestled with you and you are a wrestler. You know what it's all about. But I wrestled with him, and he was like, if you get down on the mat there, just put your, you know, just let me ease myself in here, like, and, you know, you're giving to him. Anyway, I made a mistake of actually letting him get down and get my leg, and he was damn well hurting it.
Oh, geez.
So I said to him, I wouldn't give him the satisfaction of screaming and shouting, which is what he wanted. So I let it back. I put my hands behind my head. I said, Stu, if you carry on doing that, you're going to injure my leg. I'm supposed to be wrestling for you in Edmonton tomorrow. If you don't let my leg go, I'm not going to be there. So he let it go. Anyway, it was like a few days later, I was in the, I went up there again, back on the mat. And he says to me, have you seen this submission? Just get down and, you know, just give me your arm. I said, Stu.
No thanks.
If you want it, I walked into the middle of the ring. I said, if you want it, come and get it if you can. I said, but I can wrestle. I said, and you're going to have your hands full. I said, the art of wrestling is the art of positioning. I said, if you want it, come and position it yourself. But I said, I know for a fact you can't do it. He never bothered me with that again.
Did let me ask you about this. I always heard that he had the little nails in the wall. Was it in a small ring? Was it a ring that was basically surrounded by walls?
No, there wasn't a ring there. There was just mats and walls.
Okay. And walls. Did he have nails? I've had people tell me stories of Mongolian Stomper, Archie Goldie. Archie trained with Stu. And Mongolian Stomper told me that Stu had the little nails in the wall, and sometimes he would grab guys up, and he knew where the nails were. He would drive them back onto the nails. They were little thin nails, not too long, maybe stick out maybe an inch, but enough to, you know, be painful to, you know, if you were jammed into one and it went into your body, it would certainly hurt. I was just curious if you... Have you ever see anything, any nails in those walls?
No, but it had weights and things like that all around the place, and he'd sort of throw people into the weights if he could. But the thing is, this is what he'd do. Like I say, Stu was a phony. I don't think he could wrestle to save his bloody life if he came to like real sort of real wrestling with a real wrestler. A guy'd go out there because he wanted to learn to wrestle. So Stu, first of all, would have him wrestling with a Dynamite Kid, wrestling with like loads of guys there that could wrestle, and they would soften him up. The poor guy, by the time Stu was going to get hold of him, he'd be, I mean, the guy would be blown up. He'd be breathing through his backside. He wouldn't know if he was coming, going, or anything else. Could hardly stand up. Absolutely hyperventilated. Stu would then get on top of him, lay his weight on the guy's chest so that he couldn't breathe. He'd put some hold on him that put your arm up here and all that sort of stuff, and sort of sucker the guy into a position where he'd be laying on his chest. The guy couldn't breathe because the other guys would have run him sort of ragged. Then he'd do a thing he called mugging. He'd pinch the guy's nose with his fingers and cup his hand over the guy's mouth while he was leaning on him. And then he'd be going like, can you feel this? I mean, the guy was a raving sadist, you know? Anyway, he had some guy up there that he did this to, because he'd do this to everybody that went there, if he could. Laid on the guy's chest, and the guy, his kids actually made a tape recorder and they kept playing all the time, and I heard it, and it was quite horrific. It was horrible. The guy was going, I'm sorry, please, I'm sorry. I don't know what he was like apologizing for or anything like that, but the guy got to be so frightened, so hyperventilated, because Stu kept suffocating him, laying on his chest and stopping him from breathing when the other ones had run him sort of ragged and already had him hyperventilated. The guy crapped all over Stu. You know something? Stu still wouldn't let him go. You could hear Stu going like, have a bit of dignity. Have a bit of dignity.
Oh God.
He was crap all over him. And you could hear the other wrestlers there, like his kids, screaming with laughter. And they started to play it for me. I said, turn that shit off. I don't want to bloody hear any, you know, I mean, that's horrible. That's not right.
So let's go back, jump back to Europe a little bit. Tell me some of the titles that you held in Europe.
Well, the first title I had, I was the Welsh lightweight champion. Never actually had a belt because the former champion, Johnny Williams, I think it was, I took it off. He actually lost it in Hong Kong. I mean, didn't actually lose it by being beaten or anything like that. I don't know if they sort of stole it in customs or sort of something like that. But he went out there as a Welsh champion. He was a Welsh champion while he was there. He came back as a Welsh champion, but never actually had a belt. And I was the Welsh lightweight champion, the Welsh welterweight champion. Then the most important one that I actually won was the European middleweight title. And I actually took that off a guy called Joseph Ski. He was a Polish wrestler. I took that title off him in Dublin in Ireland. And by the time I got back to like the mainland, time I got back to England from Ireland, Linda said to me, she wasn't actually with me in Ireland when I won it. She said the newspapers have been calling. They want to do an article on you. They actually did like a 3-week life story thing on me. But the climax of that was they wanted a photograph of me wearing the belt, the European belt. And I said to him, you can take a photograph of me wearing the belt, but it's got to be where I want it. And what I actually did is, see, when I was a coal miner, all the coal miners, my father included, you can't be a wrestler, you're too small. Little guys like you, have you seen the size of those wrestlers? They'll bloody eat you alive. You know, you can't be a wrestler and all that kind of stuff. So I made my mind up that if they wanted to take a photograph of me, they were going to take a photograph of me at the coal mine with the coal miners and my father coming up the pit just to show them. It was like a way of giving them that. Yeah. Or that. Like,
yeah.
I went back there to the coal mine. I knew what time my father came up. He came up like and with the other miners, and I said, you lot stay there. They were in the cage, all like looking through the cage, like what's going on, everything like that. I had my father there. I'm standing there. I've got an ostrich feather fan. I've got those big boots. You remember those big boots with the big heels and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
I'm all dressed up like Silver Fox and a scarlet sort of gown, a velvet gown with all the things. And I'm standing there with my father. He's got his coal miner's helmet on and all the rest of it. And that got to be one of the most famous photographs ever. The guy that did that documentary on me, The Life and Times of Exotic Adrian Street, he said it was the most important pre-war photograph ever taken. And he said it actually epitomized Britain's transition from the industrial age into the entertainment age. And that photograph is absolutely, like you said, like one of the most important iconic photographs that was ever taken in this country.
Pretty amazing. I saw that photograph. I'm familiar with that photograph. And it is a really amazing shot. Shot inside the mine. Looks like it was actually inside the mine.
Yeah.
No.
People have told me all my life, I can't do that. I can't do it. But if I make my mind up, I want to do something, I'm going to do it. I mean, for instance, wrestling was fantastic in this country. But then all of a sudden, there's a guy called Max Crabtree got to be, he was a good promoter. He was a good wrestler and a good promoter on a small scale. But Joint Promotions made him into like the main guy and everything like that. So he was calling all the shots. He brought his big fat brother out of retirement and made him into a superstar by getting like top wrestlers to actually lose to him, which gave him sort of a certain amount of credibility and the people sort of believed him and everything like that. But he was pathetic. He was awful. And instead of being proud to be a wrestler, which I wanted to be all my life, and I was, and a good one, all of a sudden I was getting to be ashamed to be a professional wrestler in this country. They had a Giant Haystacks. Neither of them could wrestle at all. I mean, if Giant Haystacks had been hung for being a wrestler, he would have died innocent.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
He was not big. He was certainly not the size you'd find a wrestler. Anybody that could really wrestle, not going to be that size for sure. Have a difficult time.
And as far as Big Daddy was concerned, Shirley Crabtree, you push him on his backside, he'd rock himself to sleep trying to get back up again. Anyway, I said, right, I'm going to leave. I'm going to go to the States. That is the reason I decided to leave Britain and come over to the States. By this time, I was 40 years of age, and they said, like, you're too old, like, you should think about retiring. And they said, you can't wrestle in the States, that's a land of giants. Have you seen the size of those guys over there? You know what I mean? They're bloody enormous, you know. You're going to be like Gulliver in the Land of Giants over there. I said, yeah, well, okay. I've been told I can't do stuff before I'm going. And I went. And right enough, I mean, they got some bloody big guys over here. And I might be wrestling with a guy. And I'm standing there looking at him. He'd come over to me and say, like, I think we're wrestling each other tonight. And I'd be looking up his nose. And he'd say to me, like, how can a big guy like me lose to a little guy like you? And I said, don't worry about it, mate. When we get in there, I'll show you. If guys had that sort of big man attitude with me and everything like that, then I actually got, you know, I actually ended up sort of hurting some of them. And I got a bit of a reputation for being a bully. But I wouldn't do it. I mean, if a guy was right enough and didn't have that silly attitude, we'd go in there and I'd get out of him whenever I could. I'd have a good match if I could. But don't come up to me and start sort of saying, like, you can't beat me because I'm a big man, because it just kind of rubbed my ego up the wrong way, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can understand that. Let me ask you something about you started in around 57 or so. How long was it before you became Adrian? You do about 5 years to kind of find yourself. Is that correct?
Well, first of all, I wrestled as Kid Tiles and Jonathan when I wrestled on the opposition. But in 1961, when I started wrestling, I was 20 years of age by then. When I started wrestling for the big time promoters, Joint Promotions, they didn't like my name, Kid Tiles and Jonathan. I was kind of upset about that because I had a lot of photographs in bodybuilding magazines, and I was Kid Jonathan or Kid Tarzan Jonathan in that. They wouldn't have it. They said no. And Les Martin, it was like Dale Martin, it was Jack Dale and Les Martin. They were the promoters. Les Martin decided that I was going to be Adrian Stewart. And they actually billed me a few times as Adrian Stewart. And I went into the office and said, I'm not Adrian Stewart. I said, why can't I be Kid Tarzan Jonathan? You know, because I felt like it made it a little bit famous. And Les Martin said, no. He said, you know, Adrian Stewart sounds better. He said, the other thing sounds like too much like a fairground sort of boxer or sort of something. And I said, well, I was. So he says, I said, if I can't be Kid Tarzan Jonathan, I said, you call me my real name. My real name is Adrian Street. And I, quite honestly, I did myself a mischief. He didn't like that very much. And whereas before, he was the one that actually got me, it was Les Martin actually gave me my break. But then Jack Dale was like the real boss type of a thing. And he was like all in. I mean, he was into shoot wrestling and everything like that, like you wouldn't believe. So, I mean, he had me go in there for a tryout. And he put me on with a guy called Alan Butts. And Alan Butts had been in the Olympics. He represented Britain in the Olympics as a middleweight. And this was a guy that wrestled a number of times with Tommy Charles in the amateurs. And this is one guy that even Tony Charles couldn't beat. So anyway, when I got my tryout with him, this guy turned me inside out because I wasn't such a good shooter then as I got to be. It was after that I really learned to shoot. Like I said, I could fight. But anyway, I managed to get away from this guy. I mean, this guy turned me upside down, inside out, threw me on the floor, but I managed to get away from him and stand up. No sooner I was on my feet than he had me down again. I mean, like every time I got up, whatever it was that he got me down with, I was a sucker for it because he got me with it again. Anyway, finally I managed to get away again, and it had only been a matter of time before he'd have got me and I wouldn't have been able to get out. But anyway, Jack Dale said, come here, get out of the ring. So I got out of the ring, and I followed him into the shower room. And I thought, this is it. He's going to tell me to get lost, and he won't give me a match, because I hadn't actually wrestled for him at this time. He said, "It's the Lancashire turns you did." He said, "We're really good." He said, "Like I'm going to get you started." He said, and "I'm going to give you a manager." And he said, "Mike Dimitri." He said, "Mike Dimitri's going to be a manager." Well, Mike Dimitri actually was one hell of a shooter. And that's like another story. But anyway, that's how I actually got my start, was like getting turned inside out. But apparently I was doing something right. Doing the Lancashire turns, I didn't even know what a Lancashire turn was. And then it was just like instinct. That was like the way I did it. Because I do have good instincts when it comes to fighting and everything.
So Tony Charles, you brought his name up a couple of times. Tony wrestled for me, came in and started wrestling for me in Southeastern Knoxville, probably 1977. Stayed with me for several years. Went to open up Pensacola down there in 1978. Tony went down there in Pensacola, fell in love with it like you did. You know, what was really amazing is I find that, quite simple, both of y'all being from the same part of the world end up coming to Pensacola. And I don't know that Tony ever left either. He stayed there for many, many years in Pensacola. After he quit wrestling for me, I think he retired, or he may have gone some other places and wrestled some. But he spent basically 5 years with me, and I knew he had all those backgrounds. I mean, you know, he was a shooter and a tough son of a gun. And I really loved watching his matches too, as I do you. I mean, he had that same type of style. It's really funny that years later, after Tony's gone, you come and you fall in love with the same area there and spend a lot of time there. When did you actually start putting on the clothes and start doing the outfits? And was that from the very beginning, or did you start that later on, a little later on in your career?
When I was Kid Tarzan Jonathan, I wrestled barefoot for a while, because the boots I wore to wrestle and everything before that, when I was like trying to teach myself to be a wrestler, kind of got scuffed and what have you. And I actually wore some sort of like string sandal things and everything like that to actually walk to the ring. Then I dropped those off and wrestled barefoot. But then I hurt my feet a number of times. So I actually bought some boots. But then by the time I started wrestling for the big time, they got sort of scuffed up again and what have you. So I wanted to get some more. I managed to get a pair of white boots. They were okay for a while. But then one thing I noticed I had some great wrestlers in Britain. I mean, you know, when it came to actual wrestling, to real sort of wrestling and everything like that, great wrestlers. But the thing is, I was disappointed when I used to go watch wrestling and everything like that when I was a kid, disappointed with the way a lot of them dressed. They were like really drab, you know, and very often you'd have a job to tell the difference between like the wrestler and his opponent, because there was like no variety. You know, I first became aware of wrestling through a friend of mine who used to get a lot of American wrestling magazines. And like the flamboyant people, especially people like Don Lear Jonathan, Nature Boy Buddy Rogers was a favorite of mine. In actual fact, I wrestled all over Europe as Nature Boy Adrian Street 17 years before Ric Flair had his first professional contest.
I certainly remember Rogers, obviously. So once you got to putting together your outfits and things like that, how did guys accept you?
They didn't accept it at all, because I mean, for one thing, obviously if I dressed up flashy, and they were all like wearing old Christopher Robin dressing gowns and stuff like that when I went to the ring. And the boots were always black or brown and little short boots. The time I sort of really did a transition I had a pair of powder blue boots. I got some trunks specially made to go with them that was exactly the same color. Then I got like the kind of jacket made that Nature Boy Buddy Rogers would have worn. It was like a powder blue velvet to match my boots, and the lining was like silver lame. Then I got my hair bleached to look like Nature Boy Buddy Rogers. I got my hair bleached and everything like that. So then all of a sudden I've gone from a dark-haired boy to this sort of puffy sleeves and everything like that, powder blue trunks, powder blue boots to match and everything like that. And I thought I looked terrific. But the funny thing is, that is, that actually made my image. Because when I walked to the ring, I mean, when I got dressed in the dressing room, I mean, yeah, the other wrestlers said, oh, God, you're not going to go in. You're not going to go out there like that, surely. Oh, I mean, come on. And I thought, I'm going to get some response with this. I did, but it wasn't a response I expected. Now, I imagined the crowd to go like, oh, doesn't he look great? You know, what a terrific little athlete. I mean, at that time, I had a 27-inch waist, a great suntan, a 47-inch chest. There was like 20 inches difference between my chest and my waist. I had good arms and everything like that, the blonde hair, the gown and all that sort of stuff. So I went marching out and everything like that. I thought everybody was going to fall in love with me. Instead, I was like, woo, Mary, give us a kiss.
So I can see that.
I'm going like, who'd want to kiss you, you big fat son? You know what I mean? Oh, come on, Mary, you know, give us a cuddle. Who'd want to cuddle you? I like my men more. I said, I like my men more masculine. You're too effeminate for me. So I threw it back at him. Then my opponent made a mistake of sort of doing the, like the limp wrist sort of thing and everything like that, the crowd. Like he got in on the act, like taking the piss. So whenever I got in the ring, I thought, right, you wait. So I'm blowing kisses back to the people and everything like that. He blew a kiss to me, then he turned around like waiting for the bell. By the time the bell rang, I was over there, goosed him up the backside. He nearly jumped over the corner post. And the crowd went nuts. But I was really disgusted, and I wasn't happy at all. But I turned it back like, you know, could you imagine when I went back in the dressing room, I thought, you know, you're going to go nuts because I didn't get a response from the people I thought I'd get. But I thought, I'm going to play this up to the hilt because I'm not going to go back in there and give the other wrestlers the satisfaction of seeing me sort of do something daft, you know what I mean? Which is almost like what it turned out to be. So, I mean, could you imagine walking into a party, tripping over the mat or something like that, and falling face first in a sherry trifle or something, coming up like with pineapple rings in your eyes and a bloody big cherry and cream all over your face. You know, I mean, to make you say, you get up and go like, oh, yeah, I meant to do that. So I walk back in the dressing room as if I meant to do it, you know. So I just wanted to turn it back on him. But then I thought to myself, damn, that wasn't a response I wanted. That wasn't a reaction I got it. But then those words stuck in my mind, a reaction and response. It might not have been what I wanted, but it was like far more bloody reaction and response than anybody else got that night. As you may have noticed, I'm a sucker for attention.
Yeah, a little bit.
Certainly a little bit. I bet that, as tall as you are, I bet that never went over your head.
As tall as I am, I kind of get a lot of attention too, you know. Every time I walk in someplace, everybody's got to look. How tall is that guy? So basically, when you went out, you were expecting to be a baby face and you were accepted as a heel.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what happened, right?
I thought to myself, well, if that's what you people want, you're going to get it. And I just took off from there. I just kept pushing the envelope all the time. I even got to the stage where I put like a little bit of makeup on my eyes, like a little bit of blue over there, but just a hint. So I'd walk to the ring and I'd hear people say, is he wearing makeup? So he wasn't really sure if I was or not. But then when I start getting used to that, I start sort of doing it more. sticking sequins on my face, putting glitter on there and everything like that. But then there was a wrestler named Brian Glover. He's the wrestler's Leon Harris. He got to be in like a lot of movies and stuff like that. And he used to write a lot of stuff. He was a real clever guy. He was a school teacher, but you know, he was also a wrestler on his side because his father was a promoter. But he was like a real clever guy, and he'd written like a lot of stuff. And he wrote a thing for TV, a TV play called A Drink Out of the Bottle. And he had a character in it called Lucky Day. And the character was absolutely based on me. So anyway, the BBC went nuts about it. Yeah, we've got to do this. Who can play this character? Who can be this character? Because it's like a really complex character, you know? And the whole thing was based on me, because in spite of this guy being an exaggerated version of what I was, he was also a tough bastard, and he could hurt people. And that was me. They couldn't find anybody that could actually do that except me. And I got paid a lot of money for actually doing it, so I was Lucky Day. But they exaggerated me even more, and they wanted me to wear lipstick and even more makeup. And that's the reason I did. I never wore, in spite of all the sort of elaborate stuff I do, I really felt sort of like wearing lipstick was like a bit too puffy, you know? Just a little bit too much even for me. But anyway, that's what they wanted for the film. So Lucky Day was like me, only sort of even more exaggerated. But after I did that, I thought to myself, well, everybody saw the film. It was a great success. Diana Dawes called me up. She just saw it. She called me up and she said, that was fantastic. Like, you know, I mean, I got like all kinds of credit for doing it. So then I really went all hog, lipstick and the whole nine yards. And then I went from there, like wearing silver lipstick, green lipstick, blue lipstick. I looked like I'd been blown a snowman.
I'm going to let my co-host here jump in here with me a little bit, Adrian, ask you a few questions. Gosh, you've got such a phenomenal life and so many things we haven't gotten into yet. Jeff, have you got some questions for Adrian?
Well, you know, Ron, first of all, you know, there's just nothing to talk to Adrian about. He's, you know, his career has been so short. Oh, my God, Adrian, 4 decades of wrestling. That's just crazy. So one of the questions I wanted to ask you first off is, here in the United States, they are taking the annual Hall of Fame nominees and ballots. It's a big thing that happens towards the end of the year as they look back on wrestling history. And one of the names that here on the network that Ron and I are both on, the Arcadian Vanguard Network, one of the names that's very controversial, and it's a name that you brought up, is Big Daddy. And there are people that think he should not in any way be near it. I kind of think I know where you're going to go, but they don't think he should be anywhere near any sort of Hall of Fame ballot. And then there are people that are very strong advocates for him being on a Hall of Fame ballot. So tell us your thoughts on any sort of potential Hall of Fame candidacy for Big Daddy.
He shouldn't be. He was not a wrestler at all. And the funny thing is, when I wrestled on the Independence, there was 3 Crabtree brothers, and they were all wrestlers. Brian, Max, and Shirley, who was Big Daddy. Back in 1958, I was still wrestling on the Independence, and I was wrestling for a guy called Tony DiMarto, who runs shows mostly around London, and we were in the Caledonian Bars. I was wrestling with a guy called Leon Fortuna, the Friendly Islander. He was supposed to be from Tonga. We were the only contest that wasn't... There was a Hungarian team over, a heavyweight, a light heavyweight, and a lightweight Hungarian team. The heavyweight was on the card wrestling against Shirley Crabtree. The light heavyweight Hungarian wrestled against Max Crabtree. And the lightweight Hungarian wrestled against Brian Crabtree. Well, Brian Crabtree was the first contest on. He got hurt. In fact, Shirley came down to the ring and had to carry him from the ring. And Brian said, then I'll never wrestle again. And he never did. He became a referee. Max wrestled with the light heavyweight. They had a bloody good match, actually. Possibly the best match that was on. I don't like Max, but you still got to give credit where credit's due, you know. But anyway, Shirley got in with the heavyweight, and who should walk down the aisle but Bert Azzurati, who was really gunning for Shirley Crabtree, because they built Shirley Crabtree as a British or British Commonwealth champion or something like that. And Bert Azzurati had retired by then. Bert Azzurati was about 5'6". He weighed 265 pounds at 5'6". Bert Azzurati was a killer. I could tell you stories about him that make your blood curdle. I mean, he was nasty. Tough. There's anything you could do to him that he wouldn't sort of enjoy you doing. You could kick him in the teeth, he'd love it. But I tell you what, you could beat him up and beat him up and beat him up. And eventually you'd blow up. When you blow up and you couldn't sort of hit him anymore, then it was Bert's turn. And what he did to his opponents wasn't for the squeamish. Big Daddy, or Shirley Crabtree as he was then, was terrified of him. He came down the aisle and he said, I want you, and threatened to get in the ring. Shirley ran out of the ring and he said, I'll never wrestle again either. And he actually retired for 10 years. He never came back until Bert Azzurati was an old cripple and could hardly walk, let alone get in the ring. He wouldn't come back until Bert was out of the business. And when he came back, first of all, they called him the giant guardsman. He went into the ring like wearing a big busby and everything like that. But that was like just before Max had the book off joint promotions. When he had a book of joint promotions and it was like up to Max what everything did, then he turned him into Big Daddy, and that's how he came to be.
So let me ask you, since you mentioned Tony Charles earlier, and a lot of people here in the United States are people that I know are big fans of the quote unquote British style of wrestling. And Tony Charles was certainly one of the people that wrestled that way. But also there were guys like Billy Robinson. Tell us what you thought of Billy Robinson.
Billy Robinson was a great straight wrestler. He was a good pro wrestler, but he was a bully too. I know that Billy hurt a lot of people. I like Billy, but I thought he was unnecessarily rough sometimes.
Okay, and the last British guy that I want to ask you about, a guy that also made a tremendous impact here, not only in this country, but in Canada and especially in Japan, and that's Tom Billington, the Dynamite Kid. What were your thoughts on him?
I liked him a lot. He had a very, very cruel sense of humor. A lot of people didn't like him for that. Not only did I like Tommy, but when we lived in Calgary, first of all, we lived in a house that was right on the outskirts of town. We didn't like that too much because I really didn't want to drive at that time because it was like on the other side of the road and all that kind of thing. So we were a bit sort of abandoned there. Then we shared a flat with a referee of theirs, Sandy Scott. But Sandy eventually sort of crossed the border illegally and lived in the States for a number of years. And then Dynamite Kid Tommy invited Linda and I to live with him in one of his apartments, because I think he owned about three or four apartments or two apartments or something like that. Anyway, we did, and we actually lived with him. So we got on great with him, but I do know that he did some horrible things to people. So, I mean, there's people that said he wasn't very nice. It's all according to who you were. He wasn't very nice to certain people, but he was always very, very nice to us.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you, our producer Lou Kippelman, doing some solid research here, has informed me, and it was a name that I wanted to ask you about, that in May of 1982, you went out to the Los Angeles area where you were teaming with Timothy Flowers and you won the America's Tag Team titles. First of all, memories of Timothy Flowers and working the Olympic Auditorium, one of the great historical sites in this country.
I didn't like Timothy Flowers at all. And I actually won the tag titles on my own. I presented him. First of all, I won the America's heavyweight title from Sweet Brown Sugar. Then I challenged Gentleman Chris Adams and Ringo Rigby, who were the America's tag team champions. I challenged them, and they said, "Who's your tag partner?" I said, "I don't need one." And I took the title off them. I took the title off them on my own. They challenged me a number of times, and I defeated them when I tried to get the titles back. Eventually, I wrestled them both, and I said, "If you don't win this time, you're going to split your tag team. You won't be a tag team anymore." I did that, and I beat them both doing that, and then we did a match where they said they would be the champions again and it'd be a loser leave town. I did that and they both left town. I think Chris Adams went to Oregon or somewhere, and I'm not sure if Ringo Rigby went back to the UK. But anyway, that was the end of them. And then there was like a Japanese team came over, and these two guys were huge, two really big guys. And they said it wouldn't look right for me to wrestle them on my own. So would I pick a tag team partner? Well, the closest I could see to something that complimented myself was Timothy Flowers, merely because he was blonde and he wore a very elaborate Japanese kimono. So I said, "I'll have him." And that was that. Funny thing is, I got to wrestle with, Mil Máscaras, in the auditorium, the Olympic auditorium, and neither of us had ever lost a match there. So it was billed as the Battle of the Undefeated. And as you know, like in Los Angeles, it's got like a huge Latino following. So, I mean, our place was absolutely heaving. And I was wrestling with him, giving him a good hiding. As you might know, he didn't sell for anybody.
I was going to say, I didn't think that you went over in that match.
I worked with him myself, too. I've had that experience.
He wouldn't sell for anybody. I tell you what, he sold for me. He had no option.
Good.
The climax was Timothy Flowers jumped in the ring while I was wrestling with him, and he joined in, like, kicking Mil Máscaras. So I actually got disqualified, and that's the way that ended. I was still a champion, but I got disqualified. And the fact that I actually lost the match on a disqualification, I got all of Timothy Flowers and kicked the hell out of him. And that split our team because I didn't want him as a tag team partner anymore. But we did a series of matches with that. Now, Timothy Flowers was another one that didn't like being upstaged. And needless to say, he was. Now, the funny thing is, in order to upstage me, I was supposed not to know about this. But it's just the way it sort of worked out. It kind of backfired. In order to upstage me, and I'm supposed not to have known about it, Timothy Flowers decided he was going to get married in the ring in Las Vegas. And they got all that sorted. And what was going to happen was that when he went to the ring, and I was going to come to the ring, like, after him, he'd play my music and I'd sort of come to the ring. They stopped me from coming and they said, "Right, this is it." They had a preacher in the ring. His wife came in the ring. They got married in the ring, and he thought, "That's it. Top that, Adrian Street." So anyway, I came out, wrestled him, beat him, stomped on his Christmas crackers. I called to his wife. I said, "You're not going to have a great honeymoon, now are you?" But the funny thing is, we all went back then to the hotel, and the actual show is going to be shown later on. So we actually watched the match and the wedding and everything like that on TV that night. Everything went as Timothy Flowers wanted, got married and all the rest of it. And then there's my music, a fanfare. And they said, turned out that his opponent, Exotic Adrian Street, is prettier and more feminine than the wife, than the bride. I came down everything like that, and it was my show.
That's great. So you didn't really answer. Did you enjoy working the Olympic Auditorium?
Oh, yeah, I really did. I mean, apart from the fact that the Olympic Auditorium has like a history and everything like that of wrestling. Oh, the atmosphere that you get there, because, I mean, that place would be packed. It'd be absolutely packed. The people were there all around, like, going up. It was like being in a Roman arena. I loved it. I really liked the Olympic Auditorium. And the thing is, I don't know if you remember, when I came in for you in 1985, I remember talking to you on the phone, and I said, "Ron, don't book me yet. I've got this thing to do, and I haven't got the exact date for it, but don't bill me yet because I want to do this thing first."
Right.
And I actually did the film, Grunt the Wrestling Movie, and that was filmed in the auditorium, like the big battle royal that we had. And they gave me my own show as well, the Exotic Adrian Street Show. You've probably seen some of the footage and everything from that. Because one of the shows that I did was interviewing John Tolas, because he was the manager then of The Mask. It was leading up to this battle royal where there was going to be a new world champion. And I was in that, and Linda was in it, and all that kind of thing. And that was really neat. In actual fact, at that particular time, I only had four songs out. I had two single records out, you know, with two sides. And I actually used three of the four tunes. I had to actually use three of those in the movie.
Pretty amazing. I mean, your life has just been something else. Well, Adrian, this has been great. There's so many more things I want to get to and talk to you about that I haven't had the opportunity. You know, I don't know that fans around the world are knowledgeable about how many things you have done musically. For instance, you sing songs. I don't know how many of them you wrote yourself. I mean, you've been in movies. I mean, everything. You've done it all.
Yeah, I wrote all the songs. Some of them co-with John Woods. He's the guy that actually does the music on that. But just recently, Burger Records in California, Burger Records have not only reissued my first album on vinyl, on CD, and on cassette, but they've just brought out my second album, Naughty But It's Nice. And that's never been on anything, but it's actually on it's Spotify. You can actually hear all the music from both records on Spotify right now.
Oh, great! I mean, you know, like I say, you're so talented, you know, and you've been in movies. You were in Quest for Fire, right?
Yeah.
You know, did you play one of those major parts? There wasn't a lot of people in that movie, as I remember. Not a lot of talk either. I mean, I love that movie. I had never realized you were in it till I saw this lately somewhere, that you were in that movie.
Yeah, I was in Canterbury Tales.
Right.
A Drink Out of the Bottle, Grunt the Wrestling Movie. And they're actually, in the near future, they're going to be making a feature movie by my life story. They were even talking about trying to get Anthony Hopkins to play my father.
Oh, jeez, man. That'll be a big time. That'll be a big time film. Well, Adrian, we're gonna close this out, and I want to thank you for this first part, and we're gonna bring you back on the second one. Thankfully, you're willing to come back, and we have so much more to talk about. We haven't gotten to any continental, southeastern, so many things. I'd like to talk to you about, you know, your Sadist and Sequins film. I mean, you've got a documentary out. I mean, there's so many things happening in your life. You're not only a singer and a writer, you're a painter. I mean, you do all these things. You're an extremely talented guy and a tough son of a bitch, too. It's just really been a pleasure for me today, Adrian, to have you on here. And I look forward to bringing you back again. And let's finish this journey. I mean, your life is just remarkable, my man.
It's been a pleasure for us to please say hello to the boys, especially to Bob Armstrong and Gail. They're really very, very good friends of ours.
No, I certainly will. And, you know, you guys are very much missed here. You know, we miss you here. And, you know, you are such a fine human being, you and Linda both. And y'all are just y'all really made a place for yourselves and a name for yourselves. And we're wonderful people in Pensacola, and we miss you in that area there. I know Bob and them, and I definitely will say hello for you to Bob and Gail, and we'll be doing part two with you. It will come out. I think it's going to come out on the 31st. Actually, it's going to come out on New Year's Eve. So, and thank you very much for your time today, Adrian, and look forward to part two.
Okay, thank you, Brian.
Thank you for being a patron and supporting all Studcast with your donation for this month's Super Studcast and the rest of the story. We're honored to bring these super events to our growing list of donors and appreciate your comments and feedback so we can continue to improve upon the 3 hours of unique and focused content we hope you've enjoyed. We encourage you to tell your friends about the Super Studcast and the rest of the story so the stud can continue to highlight the awesome history of his family and the sport we all love. So saddle up and ride the second and fourth Sunday of each month as we open the vault and spotlight wrestling history. This is David Summers thanking you on behalf of all the staff, including the great Brian Last and Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains. Another Super Studcast is done.